Hello and welcome to episode 193 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. Also home of top 10 most teriyaki restaurants in the country.
There we go. That's what we're about in Renton, Washington.
That's what we're about right now. We're in off-season mode. We're kicking off.
Hey, whoa. We're in teriyaki season mode.
Great point. We're kicking off our search for Seattle's best teriyaki. But before we get to that, I have a proposed segment for you. So I was thinking about the fact that this is episode 193.
Okay.
And it was making me think of 1993.
Oh, my God.
Which is such a classic year to
me. What a year. A
classic year. And it occurs to me that we're inevitably going to go through the rest of the 90s as we continue through these episodes. And I want to, at the top of each episode, with no research whatsoever, talk about sports memories and maybe other memories of each of these years.
Oh, wow.
You're a big fan of Deadspin's Let's Remember Some Guys, R.I.P. Deadspin. This is Let's Remember Some Years.
Absolutely, we should.
So 1993.
Wow, are we start? We need to have the beer for this all right, first.
Fine.
Jesus,
we're gonna have
Christ.
To toast it. We're gonna have to toast all of these
for the whole energy of 1993.
Right. Yeah, because we were doing a lot of drinking
when
beer.
I was eight. Okay, so what we're drinking here today? Before we remember some years, man, I love this segment. You knew exactly.
Oh, of course I knew. You were
You're like,
love
I have
segment.
A new segment to propose to you, and I was a little nervous, but then you said it was about the 90s, and I was really excited. What we are drinking here today from our future good friends at Silver City Brewery in Silverdale, Washington, our wishcasting good friends.
Yes. Aspirational good friends.
Is the Heroes for Ghosts White IPA. The favorite IPA of all NFL executives.
Oh, no.
Heroes for Ghosts White IPA. Delightful, delicate, and refreshing. This spin on a classic Belgian-style wit beer. One could say the original hazy style is enhanced by a...
I don't think that was in there.
No, it actually does.
It says...
It's implied. Is enhanced by a robust dry hopping process, offering up bright citrus character against a soft, weedy texture. The hops we have in here are... I love when there's more information than you need. Liberty, Amarillo, and Cascade.
There you go. Love some Cascade hops.
6.8% alcohol by volume. Let's drink some Heroes for Ghosts and talk about 1993.
We also could have talked about Cube 93 in this segment. We've done multiple segments on the past in Cube 93, and we will.
It'll
continue.
Come up.
Oh, good, good. Yes. Can't wait. The weird thing is, even though this is by no means the most successful part of 1993. One of the first things I always think of is the Mariners, because 1993 was the year it all began. Something they actually touted in their commercials at the time, and it turned out to be sort of correct. Like, it didn't culminate in the World Championship, in the World Series Championship that they were predicting.
You should tout 2002 is the year it all began. The losing streak.
No, do not do that. That Skippy Nordqvist in those commercials back in 1993, before they settled on their current style of ads that they've gone to for the last 20 years or so. They hired Lou Piniella. Chris Bosio threw the first no-hitter in franchise history. Ken Griffey homered in 8 consecutive games. Richie Amarillo had his thrilling rookie season that captured the hearts of many Peltons, including our cousin David. He was both of our favorite player. And we started paying attention to the Mariners for the first time in our life. So a notable year in 1993, I would say. Also the new colors, that was part of the year it all began. The fact that they went to the current color scheme that they're still using to this day, some 26 years later, or 27 years later, the logo still holds up.
In our hearts, this was the Mariners' year in 1993. It's the first year that I remember being a person. As a year, whereas like, it's 1993. So 1993 also considered to be like one of the greatest years in rap music ever.
Yes.
You have Enter the Woo, 36 Chambers in 1993. Like this
which
was
we were not listening to whatsoever in 1993.
Oh, we were somewhat aware that Wu-Tang Clan was nothing to fuck with at the very least.
Agreed.
We have Doggy Style by Snoop Dogg. It's like this year, everything culminated, right? Of like, you know, when you flip to a new decade, you have a couple of years. We're in it right now. We're still in basically the 2010s or whatever.
We don't know what to make of the roaring 20s.
You have a couple of years where it's still like a holdover from the previous decade. And then like 3 years in, you're like, I have no recollection of 2013 whatsoever. But I do remember 2003 well. But it's just like this moment where it was like, oh, it's the 90s now. Like the 90s broke through in 1993. Do you agree with that perspective?
Not at all. But 1993 was still a symbolically important year.
Right? Like, I feel like, especially
it's not the first year I remember being as a person, but it's like a defining year. Like, to me, modern life started for me in 1993.
Absolutely.
Which now is so long ago.
What year did Fresh Prince of Bel-Air debut?
I don't know. It could have been around that time. That would be a reasonable time for it to debut. Maybe a little earlier.
1990.
Okay.
Wow. But I feel like a lot of the like 90s things were really hitting in 1993, right? Like Fresh Prince was like a huge show in 93. Seinfeld was huge around this time period, right? Like all of these things that we cared about culturally were like 1993 was the first year where they were big things, right?
I don't know about the first year necessarily, but yes, again.
I mean, I have no recollection of 92. Like, and it was also, like, Sonics had a massive year in 1993, right? It was the first time, or what year do you consider 1993 for the Sonics?
Well, I consider it the whole thing, but if you say the
1993. We're talking about the playoff series that they lost to the Suns in Game 7.
Correct. They reached the Western Conference Finals, George Karl's first full season as coach, and won 57 games and had the second best record in the Western Conference that year.
It's the same thing where it's like...
to that.
A toast. That was the 90 Sonics.
Listen, I mean, you could say that when George Karl took over in 92, that was the start of the 90 Sonics, but that was when they really came into their own.
Like, a lot happened. And was this Rick Meyers' rookie year, or was that later?
It was Rick Meyers' like, rookie year.
So many things happened in Seattle. A lot of shit was
the
happening.
Year it all began.
Right? Like, the Sonics were, they were just about to start their 90s peak. The Mariners were just about to start their 90s peak. I mean, things all sort of, like, came to a head, I would say, in the mid-90s, like 95, and we'll talk about that in two episodes.
Exactly.
But that was the year where it was, like, 95, 96, where I was, like, felt like a fully grown adult. You know what I mean?
At age 10. Like, oh, no, 95, 96, at age 10.
I was aware of what was going on in, like, society and culture a little bit more. In 95, 96, like we have this, these are the Clinton years have just started in the country. Like, I just feel like things were really popping in the United States in 1993.
A transition period in Seattle sports because you had Don James resigning as UW head coach. By the way, one of the key things is no research whatsoever allowed ahead of time. And that's part of the game. Don James resigning as Husky head coach and kind of the end of them being the biggest thing in Seattle sports, even though they were still a very good team throughout most of the 1990s. And, you know, kind of the pro sports starting to take over with the Sonics first and then later the Mariners. And then not really the Seahawks.
Yeah. But the Seahawks were still like an important team that year. Like Rick Meyer was, I remember Rick Meyer being a cultural phenomenon for that one season.
Our mom bought us a Rick Meyer jersey at some point around this and then like refused to let anyone wear it because it was going to be a collector's item in her mind. One of the many things that our mom thought was going to be a collector's item that none of them have. Mm-hmm.
And still to this day, wouldn't you like to have that Rick Meyer jersey?
Actually, yeah. Now it would be a really amazing jersey. It's come full circle.
It was just, it was a great year. Like we weren't quite at the, I feel like that, like what we think of as like, the 90s heyday, right? The like mid-90s, like where we were going to Wild Waves all the time and stuff. All of it was just starting to happen, right? Like we just started. I think about Luca, like he's basically the same age. He's 7, right? He's turning 8 in May. Like he's going to be 8 this year. And for him, he's like just starting to be aware of like what's going on in society at large. You know what I mean? He still mispronounces DaBaby's name, but like he's aware of his existence.
And as I mentioned, I think perhaps before in this podcast, one of his favorite songs for a while there last summer, 93 Till Infinity.
93 Till Infinity.
Yeah.
So that's what we're about is 93 Souls of Mischief.
Yeah, they really said it well.
At, from the fine people at hiphopgoldenage.com. The top 40 hip-hop songs of 1993. Number one is Casual's Everything Around Me. Number, maybe we can do this per year. God, I hope they have this for every year from the fine people at hiphopgoldenage.com. Number two is 93 Till Infinity by Souls of Mischief.
There you go.
Electric Relaxation by Tribe Called Quest. We'll do the top five. Gin and Juice, which, like, Luca's aware as a seven-year-old in 2020, which, by the way, can't believe that's the year, in 2020 of this, I mean, both Cream and Gin and Juice, and clearly 93 Till Infinity.
Yeah. I mean, Gin and Juice is probably, like, the number one song that they were playing constantly on Cube. What was number five in the list?
Sound of the Police by KRS-One.
Hmm.
This was it. This was where everything came together in 1993. We had the sort of like old school, like sort of like lyric head hip hop, but then mainstream rap was starting to become a thing in a massive way. It was like, this is where rap music became the
I mean, 92 is really where it, I think it was a more formative year with the Chronic.
Oh yeah, 92 tipped the scales, but 93 made it real.
Okay.
So God, 1993.
Great time.
The King Griffey Jr. home run streak was like...
Well, also, that's the MLB season that is immortalized in Griffey baseball.
Right? That's what I was going to say. That is King Griffey baseball. It's 1993. Literally, for the rest of time, people will be playing the 1993 baseball season. Baseball's never been so good.
Well, I look forward to next week when we talk about 1994.
I have like so little recollections of some of the later years. Like 99... I'm looking forward to it.
You're going to come up with some stuff.
You'll remember more than me.
All right, just one toast this week for Shaquille Griffin, who will replace Richard Sherman on the NFC Pro Bowl roster. It was announced after the 49ers made the Super Bowl. We definitely can't toast to that.
Bittersweet. But also kind of amazing to see Shaquille Griffin, who when they were both playing together, you'd have moments where you're like, I can't tell which one that is. And then now Shaquille Griffin replacing Richard Sherman on the Pro Bowl roster.
It is very cool. Fitting, coming full circle moment. Bobby Wagner will not play in the Pro Bowl this weekend due to a knee injury, but according to Pete Carroll, that won't require surgery. Not that serious an injury. Now it's time
you'd love to hear it.
Now it's time to get to a listener email that was quite fun to receive earlier this week. God. The listener Chris Wheeler emailed us at peltoncast@gmail.com. Dear Tristan, Kevin, and Tristan's apparently roughly 45 children, I wrote a Peltoncast mailbag question in 2017 in which I asked for an ideal, quote, Seattle sales pitch over a weekend or so. At the time, I, Seattle native, Garfield grad, was trying to convince my partner, Connecticut native, that we should move to Seattle. You made a number of great recommendations, a bunch of which we hit. Loretta's, a North End native I'd shamefully never been. A Cascades hike, Cary Park, Ivers, Gasworks, etc. The trip went great. She really enjoyed it. So 2 years later, we're still here in Brooklyn. But we're now moving to the Pacific Northwest this spring, officially, in part because of the good work you guys did guiding my sales pitch. She has agreed to give it 2 years out there to see how it goes. But there's a twist.
Oh, wow. I was ready to give the full page ad.
Wow. We are trying to choose between Seattle and Portland. We can move to either city.
Portland!
We're taking a week in early February to spend 3 to 4 days in each city to explore. Our question for you, if you have time, obviously I completely understand if you don't, but we have plenty of time.
Literally nothing.
Seahawks offseason.
We just talked about 1993 for a solid 10 minutes.
We did. What advice would you offer to someone considering the two cities? What do you think of their relative strengths and weaknesses are? Is there anything an NYC person must know about either city before moving there? Obviously, people could write entire books about this, but even a few sentences from you guys would be most welcome here. Thanks again for everything you do. I love the pod and I'm among the many Pacific Northwest expats who use it as a lifeline to stay close to Seattle sports, which is why we need to advise him to
maybe stay in Brooklyn.
Finally, and maybe most importantly, if possible, I'd like to make a donation to a charity of your choice as a way of saying thanks, regardless of whether you have time for the above. Where should I give? Doug Baldwin Family First Center in Renton. You can donate to that on the City of Renton website. We did that, of course, with the proceeds from our last two live shows. So a great cause that you helped us out by attending those live shows. Okay, so Seattle versus Portland. Can you give an objective comparison?
I really think that I can, and I'm a little bit nervous about what the outcome might be.
Oh, no.
Portland's pretty great.
I mean, no, in fairness, we like only hang out in Portland when we're vacationing. You don't have to go to work when you're in Portland. You know, you don't have to deal with yard work when you're in Portland. There's like all these things of your day-to-day life that you get to escape when you go to Portland.
But what are the positives of Seattle over Portland?
Having Major League Baseball and football in college sports, D1 college, big-time D1 college sports, like Pac-12 right in the city, I think is a big plus.
So you've got football.
I mean, there's more going on in Seattle. It's a bigger city than Portland. Like, that stereotype of the two cities is accurate. And probably, even though you wouldn't say it's a strong suit for either city, probably slightly more culturally diverse than Portland.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So. The traffic is so much worse, though.
It really depends on where you're going to be and what you're going to do, I feel like. But there's just a lot of downsides to Seattle right now.
Oh, no.
I mean, like, traffic's incredibly bad. Like, weather's going to be about the same between the two. If we're doing a pros and cons
list. Always 2 degrees warmer in Portland.
Portland is probably slightly nicer, but
I don't think it's noticeable.
I guess the thing, oh, there's nothing like a spring day in Portland.
What about a spring day in Seattle?
But you're like, okay, you have football here, but you have basketball there, right?
Yes.
And like, if you had to choose a city that you were like, I can't believe I'm making a pro-Portland argument. If you had to choose a city that you were going, if you had to choose it based upon professional sports, which obviously you're not, Chris Wheeler, but it's much better to be in the city where the basketball is there every day, because they play those games on all days of the week. Football is mostly only played on weekends.
It's true.
Like, you can travel. Imagine if you had, if it was the opposite.
If I lived in Portland.
If you lived in Portland.
I would go to every Blazers game, and then I would drive up to go to Husky games.
Yeah. It'd be pretty convenient for you.
It wouldn't be so bad. I've thought about it. Don't think I have it.
This podcast would be slightly more difficult to do. You'd be one of the Seattle expats. I'd just be reporting to you about teriyaki. So lonely. I'd be like, another lonely trip to the teriyaki store today.
You said that as if we go everywhere together.
Like, I'm trying to keep the suspense up. But the thing about Portland is that Portland still feels like a small town.
Yes.
Like, the Seattle doesn't, like, you don't get the homey feel when you go to a brunch place in Seattle, you know? And I feel like when I go to Fried Egg, I'm in love in Portland, you know? There's definitely a, like a communal feeling to the city of Portland in general that I don't think exists in Seattle. At the same time, there's lots more happening in Seattle. You know, like, Seattle is just a bigger city. You know, it's a more culturally diverse city. The arts are, I think, better in Seattle. The arts in Portland are maybe, like, a little bit wackier.
There's the key Portland weird thing. That's not, you know, there's an element of that in Seattle, but it's not nearly as substantial.
I would assume that the housing and rental prices are probably slightly cheaper in Portland than they are in Seattle.
One would think.
So it also, I just feel like Portland would be, if you were planning on having 45 children, I feel like Portland would be a pretty solid city to raise children in.
You think it's that different?
I think Portland is slightly different than Seattle.
It's definitely slightly different. I mean,
now, at the same time, Seattle just has the better version of so many things, right? Although the Oregon coast is so close.
You know, I thought about referencing this when we started the podcast. After Oregon beat UW on Saturday.
Oh, God.
John Hollinger had a tweet. Let me pull this up here so I quote it accurately. Emotional scene. Tough emotional scene in Seattle this afternoon is ejected at Cape Elton, admits Oregon is a better state. To which I responded, of course, with a gif of the Sounders receiving the MLS trophy this year. But one of the most accurate replies to this, I think, was someone saying they do have a better coast.
Oregon coast, I mean, Washington coast is a million miles away. Now, you're closer to Canada in Seattle, which is definitely interesting.
That is a big thing. You're almost equidistant between Vancouver and Portland, so you can go either direction more easily.
You are.
It's a really long trip from Portland to Vancouver, BC.
Literally
a short trip to Vancouver, Washington. Also, you have to pump your own gas.
Oh. No, they changed that.
Did they?
In Oregon, yeah. I think you can choose to pump your own gas if you want. Or like the gas stations can allow you to pump your own gas.
I'm not familiar with that change.
But there are like Mount Rainier is better than any mountain that exists in Oregon. The water in Seattle is better than any water in Oregon. I think a spring day is nicer in Oregon, or in Portland, not Oregon. The rest of Oregon's terrible. But a summer day in Seattle destroys a summer day in Portland. And we've got water to go on. You can go to the mountains. You can go to a beach. Like, there's a lot that's really happening in Seattle. Just so close, right? The proximity to water and mountains, it's not the same in Portland. And like...
How you end up talking yourself into Seattle at the end.
No. I'm just, you know, I'm presenting the arguments for both. And then I'm making a conclusion.
Okay.
I think food is about the same. Definitely a little bit pricier and a little bit fancier in Seattle. But like you're going to have all the options in Seattle. If there's like a major exciting chain restaurant, they're coming to Seattle first. You know, there's like, I don't know if there's as much of a thing of like Oregon restaurants moving to LA and New York or expanding there. Seattle restaurants are just more important culturally on the map nationally.
I don't agree with that. I would not agree with that particular
statement. What else is there
that have moved to LA and New York? Besides Pock Pock, which receded from both those places, it turned out they couldn't compete there. Salt and Straw?
Salt and Straw.
Voodoo isn't in those places necessarily, but Blue Star is.
Blue Star's overrated.
It is somewhat overrated, but it's in LA. Like, you can't argue against that.
All right,
that.
Fine.
So I reject that statement.
But I think they're probably about the same. There's just kind of nothing like Seattle in the summertime, though. That's the thing, is like, they came on a summer weekend the last time. I don't think, and I also think the food you can get in Seattle is a little bit more diverse. You're closer to Vancouver, which has very excellent Asian food. Like, I'm giving Seattle the edge on food, slightly.
Man, that's a tough one. I just think the fact that you have both Portland and Vancouver within a 3-hour drive is a huge selling point for
Seattle.
That's the thing.
If
you go 3 hours south of Portland, you do get in and out if you go 3 hours south of Portland.
But 3 hours south of Portland is just like, it's wasteland. It's Eugene, Oregon. Like, nobody wants to be there.
I mean, Eugene is not quite 3 hours away.
But you've driven this before. When you're driving, it's...
I've actually never driven it.
You're driving from Seattle to San Francisco... It's like, oh, this is awesome. You're at Portland right away, right? And then there's an expanse of Oregon and Northern California, which takes 415 hours to drive through. And you're just like, how can there be this much land, right? You're just like, it has to run out. I have to run into a city at some point. But you don't. That's Eureka, California. That's going to be the capital of the Northern California that never existed. And you don't want it to exist. Like, you're going to be doing a lot of research on California secession at that point. So, there's nothing there. Move to Seattle. Go to Portland 3 times a year. I mean, we go basically every single December to Portland. Once in the spring, once in the summer. You'll get your fill of Portland, but you'll be in Seattle, which is the superior city.
I would say you don't need to limit it to 3 times a year. You can definitely go.
Or whenever.
15 times a year in my case.
Well, like, I mean, it was the nice thing. Like, I wanted to go to the Blazers' first playoff game against the Thunder, and we just drove to Portland. It was simple. Hotels also are much cheaper in Portland than they are in Seattle. Airbnbs are much cheaper in Portland than they are in Seattle. So it's an easier place to go and stay for a weekend. And you're living in Brooklyn right now, so everything will seem cheap.
That's very true. On the Portland teriyaki front, we should note this. The listener, Mike Jeremiah, at Mike Jeremiah 123, tweeted us, is the Portland listener, it's a struggle to find good teriyaki 5 years in. Others may have found good spots, but knowing there's good teriyaki in your neighborhood, Miyako's, or where you're visiting family in Nasai, or at UW on game days, BB, just hasn't been replicated here for me. And that transitions us to our search for Seattle's best teriyaki, where on the strong recommendation of multiple Jeremiahs, I assume brothers, the fabulous Jeremiah brothers, we began our search for Seattle's best teriyaki at BB's Teriyaki Grill, a location with which I was not familiar with, but should have been.
This one really escaped us.
It did. So BB's opened in 2017 on the Ave, founded by Seattle native Michael Sauvage, who apprenticed at Yoshino Teriyaki on First Hill, which we will be hitting as well, He named the restaurant after the current owner of Yoshino's and have subsequently added locations in South Lake Union and downtown. And the comparison that you see everyone make for BB's Teriyaki Grill is it's a Chipotle for teriyaki. Although really it's frankly more similar to Panda Express, not just in terms of cuisine necessarily.
I might argue that with you.
How so?
I mean, the inside looks like Chipotle.
Well, that's true. But the menu options are more like, you know, at Chipotle, there's a greater degree of customization. It's not like you're choosing different things to go into the teriyaki. It's just you get a choice of sides, which is what you also get at Panda Express.
I agree with that also.
You agree with, wow, you're really taking both sides today.
This is my new thing. Our year-end recap pod, our Seahawks recap pod, everybody was like, such a good podcast. And I was like, I took all sides. That's why.
Everyone was pleased with it. Okay, so reading from their menu, the way it works is you choose up to three sides first among white rice, brown rice, veggie stir-fry, yakisoba, cabbage salad, mixed green salad, and broccoli. Which sides did you go with?
I went with the yakisoba and the broccoli and then white rice.
Same for me. I've heard good things about their green salad, but did not give that a shot this time. Was feeling the broccoli instead.
What type of chicken? Did you get the spicy or the regular?
I got the spicy chicken.
Okay.
You got the regular?
Got the spicy, of course.
So one of the options is to do beef brisket. Did you try beef brisket?
It just didn't look as good as the spicy teriyaki.
Okay.
I was looking at it and I was like, no. I'm fascinated to try the beef brisket, but just like quality of meat wise, the spicy teriyaki looked like the best meat.
You can do an extra beef brisket as an add-on, so maybe that's the play. Although one thing that should be noted here, this will come up in our review.
You can have a little bit of beef brisket.
So much food.
It was the box after I left because I drove to the Amazon one in Westlake, which I think is pretty brand new. There's only like two reviews for it on Yelp.
Where is it like in relation to Westlake? Is it like by the Shake Shack?
Literally right next to the Chipotle.
I don't know where the Chipotle is there, so that didn't help me.
It's north of the Shake Shack, I think by quite a bit.
Oh, okay. So not actually, because there's a new complex at Ovid there, including a Rachel's Ginger Beer where a Mo'ono is going in.
I think it's pretty close to
in South Lake Union. Okay. Oh, yeah, I guess I did know that.
I don't really know where the Shake Shack is, having never been to the Seattle Shake Shack, which is kind of weird.
Still wild that you've been to multiple other Shake Shacks.
Is it still busy or is it normal now?
I don't know. I've only been late at night since then, so.
I just try not to travel to that area unless, literally the only times that I go there are if we're reviewing food for the Peloton Cast.
Accurate. They also offer you a choice of spicy sauce or regular sauce, to which I went with both.
We had the exact same order.
Outstanding. So they take, you know, now it's a compostable. If you're looking, that's one of the things about BB's. Like if you're looking for the really classic Seattle teriyaki experience, this is way too hipster for that. Everything's compostable. You know, there's tofu is an option. There's a lot of vegetarian options among the sides. You know, they're not necessarily going for the classic teriyaki, but I think that we're good. Don't worry, we're going to get to plenty of those locations. But they take the takeout. Everything is in a takeout container, and if you place the orders that we did, the one half of it is entirely filled with rice which they use as a bed for the chicken. And then the other two, you know, the other half, the other two compartments on the other side filled up with the yakisoba and the broccoli, which is how it is an immense amount of food. But the number one thing that stood out to me in this was that they poured enough of both of the sauces on there that it completely saturated the rice, which was a huge thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had that experience as well.
Yeah, I had that experience.
You're going to want a lot of teriyaki sauce.
I agree that having a lot of teriyaki sauce is a very important thing.
So I resolved that, much like we did with the ramen bracket, I'm going to evaluate these locations on four criteria. Number one, the protein, generally chicken, although as discussed, we may at some point along the way have salmon teriyaki or something, or in this case, brisket. Number two, the sauce. Number three, the extras, which encompasses rice, salad, and anything else they might throw in there. I mean, salad is probably going to be a bigger differentiator here. And then number four, value.
Okay.
So on these scales, I get
can we just talk about the feel of it still a little bit, though?
Sure.
Before we get into the rating, because I was pretty apprehensive walking in. I looked at it and I saw the signs with the ordering and I was like, okay. This is not the teriyaki place that I'm used to. Which
part did I tell you this?
Yeah, you did, but it was just like even more so being there. Part of this search is finding out if there is teriyaki that's better than the teriyaki that I'm used to.
Right.
Right? So if I'm just looking for a restaurant that's like
within 5 minutes of your house.
Or like I don't care about the location, but if I'm just like, well, this isn't like a super weird store that sells like, you know, like I was describing last week, like random shit on the menu that you have no idea why it's there. And it pops up and there's a handwritten sign for it or whatever. You know, like if that's what I'm only judging teriyaki by, that's not the right way to approach it. I have to be open to new and interesting experiences.
Yes.
So, but walking in was just like, this isn't, it feels like a teriyaki place that is specifically designed for franchising.
Yeah, 100%.
It was just like, they made this teriyaki place as like, we're going to take Seattle-style teriyaki and bring it to the masses. It's like the first time that I walked into Mod Pizza and I was like, oh, this place is polished, you know? Which is not to say that Mod Pizza isn't good. It was just like, oh, like, they're not thinking about this as like, well, we want to have one good, like when you have Maono, Maono was a restaurant, and like the one in Rachel's, like it wasn't designed to be franchised, right? Like they were able to grow and scale, but this was specifically made to be franchised. And I felt like you could sort of feel the enterprising aspects of it in a way that I was just like, it put me off the whole experience of being there. Like I was at location 3, and 5 years from now there'll be 25 locations.
Quite possibly so.
It definitely felt like we've had these conversations, we've read these stories, we're doing the search. People are looking for Seattle style teriyaki outside of Seattle, and Michael Sauvage is like, I will bring you Seattle style teriyaki outside of Seattle.
I don't see that as a negative.
It's not Seattle style teriyaki if you're taking teriyaki and turning it into Panda Express.
But it's still, if it's the food, it's still teriyaki. Then
we'll get there.
Oh. One thing that surprised me is I went on Saturday before the UW-Oregon game, and it was around noon, and it was pretty quiet at the location on the Ave, which I wasn't expecting. And that may have been a factor. It wasn't the freshest chicken. I thought it was only... the element of this is that even though it's much, much faster than you're going to get at another location, it's been sitting there clearly for a little bit. But I still thought a 7 overall.
Not that I'm
overall.
Making exaggerated agreement responses to you.
You need to be cool here.
Do I need to be cool?
Yeah.
For what reason? We're talking about teriyaki here. I need to speak my truth about teriyaki.
You had a very different experience here than I did.
I'm not.
No.
I'm not saying
the listener
can
decide whose opinion they trust more about this. Remember that one of us voted for Loretta's and one of us picked against Loretta's. And we'll never live that down. All right.
We've really differed on a lot of the look. Dozone was the only time that we've ever like...
Really... Oh, that's true. We didn't even agree on Maono. You just went through that whole rant about how great Maono is.
Tats is better.
Tats is great. The sauce, I rated a 9 because of the quantity and the quality. It wasn't the best sauce I've ever had, but it was good. It was very good. And it, like, I enjoyed every bite of rice, which is not certainly always the case when I'm eating teriyaki.
Okay.
The extras, I rated an 8, like the variety. Certainly as compared to a really cheap salad, it was an upgrade compared to that. The yakisoba I thought was only so-so, but the broccoli was very solid. And then lastly, on value terms, even though this is moderately expensive for teriyaki at $9, you're getting so much food. I didn't end up eating dinner that night because it was such a massive meal, and I ate it pretty quickly since I was in a hurry to get to the Husky game. So I rated this a 10 on value.
Okay. Maybe you need to regress your fucking opinions to the mean. You're just going through and saying that these things aren't that good and then giving like really high ratings to them. What are you doing here? To me, it's like I can look past the feel of it being slightly off. Like, I don't. Mod Pizza is in another place. Like, I fucking love eating Mod Pizza, right?
Do you?
Yeah, I do. It's great because the food is good. I don't like Mod Pizza anywhere near as much as I like Pagliacci, obviously. But it's just like, it is this, for this type of pizza is what I'm saying. You know what I mean? Like,
it's compared to like Blaze.
Yes. This just didn't rise above. I thought the teriyaki quality was worse. And I feel like it has to be better to overcome some of the like hesitations that I'm going to have. The chicken was kind of cold. You know, it wasn't freshly made chicken. Like, you can see them making it in the back, but also it's sitting in a little container for a while, right? Like, and at a teriyaki place, a neighborhood teriyaki place, you call it ahead 10 minutes ahead and you show up precisely 10 minutes after and it's fresh chicken, right? But this is like I can respect the convenience, but I just can't respect that it doesn't taste as good. There are definitely elements that, like, will I return to this location? Probably, because of how convenient it is. And also, I really liked how much sauce there was. My normal order at a teriyaki place is to get 2 cups of the salad dressing, just the garbage salad dressing, and then the teriyaki sauce. And I love how thick the teriyaki sauce is. This sauce was a lot runnier than that. And I like the really, really, like, I want it to be glazy, right? And I just get an extra cup of that, pour 2 of them on there, mix it all around in the rice and the chicken, right? So you have a thing where every bit of rice is covered in teriyaki sauce.
That is crucially important.
That teriyaki sauce is brilliant. And so this had a lot of the elements of that, but the sauce was just a little bit lighter, right? Like, it wasn't, I liked that it was spicy. I thought the chicken was high quality, but it wasn't as good as getting super fresh chicken. And the same with the yakisoba. It was like, I like the idea of yakisoba being a side, but the yakisoba itself was a solid B.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily recommend the yakisoba highly.
So, I mean, my feeling was that I felt like it needed to be really good, you know? I didn't want it to be like a B+ teriyaki, because this is a search to see if something can rise above neighborhood teriyaki. And in my opinion, I don't think that this does.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it rises above neighborhood teriyaki, but it's also, as you mentioned, it's convenient to a lot of people. You've got a lot of competition for teriyaki in the U District, but I was searching for this to, like, you know, maybe at some point meet a friend for one of these locations in the search, and there are not that many teriyaki options in downtown or the greater South Lake Union area.
And that's a shame. And obviously the location clouded my perspective on this. But it really felt like it was teriyaki as made for corporate workers. It's like super fast. You go through, you get your teriyaki.
It started on the Ave. I think you are putting too much on that. This is probably the third location.
Maybe I'll go to the Ave location and it'll feel different. But the whole setup is about convenience more than it's about teriyaki quality, right? Am I wrong about this? It's about like turning teriyaki into Chipotle or to Panda Express, where you walk in and you know the deal going into those places, right? You know the gambit. Like, the deal of the devil that you're making is, I'm not going to be eating the best quality food, but it's super fast.
I mean, you're not going to be eating the freshest food, but I think you're underrating the element to which, if you're using a higher quality of ingredients, that can make up some of that difference.
I thought the ingredients were good. It wasn't bad. It was just like probably about the same quality level as neighborhood teriyaki.
I think that's probably reasonable.
But there was a lot of it. Like, the box was dense when I was holding it, walking up to my office. It was just like, oh crap, this is a lot of food and it's a lot of rice. And like, I liked it from that perspective.
Yeah, I think if you're a small eater, easily 2 people can share one order of teriyaki.
I mean, me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius can share one order of teriyaki basically anywhere, because it's usually quite a bit of food. But
I do not have that experience.
You and me go hand in hand to every single teriyaki location. So I don't know. I think that we're both being biased on this a little bit. You're a little bit too biased pro, and I might be a little bit too biased negative, but maybe that leads us to the place of, it's good and convenient teriyaki. If anybody really liked BB's teriyaki, I would not question them for it, right?
Which, like we said, the Jeremiah's clearly do.
Like, I don't think that anybody's wrong about that. I think it's good teriyaki. And I will probably return there again if it's convenient. Because I like all teriyaki. And getting convenient teriyaki is an important thing, right? So, like, if I'm in an area where I'm like, oh, I can stop in and just grab teriyaki for a second. But that's not what the search is. You know, it's not, will I return to this location? It's not like, is this convenient teriyaki? Because it is convenient teriyaki. But I eat a Panda Express too, right? And we should definitely review Panda Express teriyaki at some point.
Oh, of course we're going to do that. Without question.
It's like, I like eating grocery store chicken teriyaki, right? Like, I like the Safeway chicken teriyaki. And I like the Panda Express teriyaki. Because teriyaki is an excellent food. But I don't think this rises above neighborhood teriyaki place.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that either. It's gonna be weird if none of them at the end we get to go through this and none of them rise about that.
That actually would not be a bad conclusion though, because then everybody wins.
It's true. It's
right?
True.
Every single person who has their favorite, we're already in the first week and we're talking about who's gonna win. But if that's the case, and there is, I don't believe that will be the case. I thought BB's was an interesting competitor.
It, for sure. It's definitely unique among the competitors we're looking at reviewing. Next week, if you're eating along with us, most likely, it depends when I'm able to go to lunch with my friend, but I want to go back to Ichiro Teriyaki in Magnolia, which was our neighborhood teriyaki when I worked at the Storm that we went to on a very regular basis.
Magnolia? You drove across the bridge for teriyaki?
I mean...
Hell yeah, you did.
No. You don't have to go across the bridge from Wedgwood. Or not Wedgwood, Interbay, I should say. You definitely do have to. It's not that far, suffice it to say.
Oh, yeah. Let's get after it.
Yeah.
Ichiro, sushi, and teriyaki?
Yes.
Hell yeah.
So that could be delayed till the following week, depending on when I'm able to get a lunch there. But
750 teriyaki chicken, flame broiled?
Yeah.
Ooh, spicy chicken teriyaki?
You're amazed that a place has spicy chicken teriyaki. I think most places offer
New York steak teriyaki. They got a lot of teriyakis here.
Also some solid bento boxes.
Ooh. Yeah, I'm about this.
Yeah.
All right. Teriyaki season continues.
Huff.
I'm on some website called Zomato.
It's not going to stop anytime soon.
Have you heard of that website?
Probably.
It's very solidly rated on Zomato.
Having discussed food, it's time now for the Coach's Corner. Sponsored by our friends Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci thinks that 8-year-olds should be able to hip check just a little bit.
No, Pagliacci does not think
and
that.
So do we.
Oh.
Oh my God.
So last
best
week,
pizza in Seattle. Just.
Yeah, just put that out there.
It's honestly, Pagliacci is more convenient than Mod Pizza.
Yeah.
Mod Pizza can be modified. Pagliacci, the pizza's just there, and it's perfect every time.
So last week was the second game for Baby Fantasy Genius, and your first full game on the sidelines. How'd it go?
Who's the new coach of the Knicks?
Mike Miller. Not that Mike Miller.
I'm like the South Dakota Mike Miller. I'm like that Mike Miller.
Because of your great playing career?
It was like George Karl when he took over for Casey Jones mid-season.
Wow. Too bad we couldn't get to that in episode 192.
We probably lost by about 20 points. But the team just really felt the energy.
Did they?
I got there and there was an email that went out this week to all the coaches that was like, remember, you have to stay seated during the games. And I was like, they should just direct this at ESPN's Kevin Pelton.
I legitimately did not know.
You're like,
rule.
You're pacing the sidelines like you're a pop or something. Getting in the ref's ear just a little bit.
Definitely not getting in the ref's ear.
You were mostly just like awkwardly pacing with your arms crossed.
I mean, no, it's mostly just yelling, no, no, defend that, find your person, find your person.
Get back, run, defense, things like that. Okay, so the team that we were playing, which, by the way, I should say these team names because they're pretty funny. It's all the teams are named after Pac-12 schools.
And your team is the Sun Devils.
We are the Sun Devils. It's been randomly assigned. I want to see what team we are playing. I think we were playing the Wildcats this week.
Oh, rivalry game. Wow. Throw out the records when the Sun Devils and the Wildcats get together. Partially because of the fact that they don't keep score in these games. You always throw out the records.
There literally are no records. Before each game, they take the records and throw them out symbolically. I want to double check who we're playing. We were indeed playing the Wildcats. And let me just tell you, I was staring down Sean Miller pregame. I was channeling my inner Herb Sendek.
Not the coach anymore. Territorial Cup.
So on the Wildcats, and the most of these leagues, I think as I described in the like children's football that I was talking about, most teams have one really good player, and then everybody else is about the same, right? Like the same level of competency with basketball. You know, you don't really have like role players in children's sports necessarily. So that was true of the Wildcats.
No 3-and-D.
I feel like Luka will become a good 3-and-D player, right? That's like what his destiny is. Maybe his destiny is to like... custodian like you, Brian Cardinal. grab rebounds over players.
Not much nearly bigger. As skilled as Brian Cardinal.
But you don't think he's your most your NBA comp?
No, I've always said Reggie Evans.
Reggie, yeah, maybe he'll.
Brian Cardinal shot threes, man. He was a good shooter.
I think Luka's gonna shoot threes. So the Wildcats had this one player who was just like really pushing the boundaries of the rules. Right? Like the rules are that you can't steal. And he wasn't stealing, but there were like passes that he was stealing. This kid is tiny, right? Like he's smaller than anybody on our team, basically. This like tiny kid. And he's just like so much more aggressive than anybody else on the court.
I was going to say Isaiah Thomas, but we have to go with an Arizona player. So Damon Stoudemire?
I guess so. He was pretty frustrating. He was like Salim Stoudemire. No. just like. So frustrating to play against, though. Like, picking off passes, like, cherry-picking, like, playing the passing lanes. When literally we're just, like, trying to complete a pass here, right? And so having this one kid, every single offensive rebound that was out there, he's grabbing these offensive rebounds because he just wanted it more than our team did. We had a practice this week where literally all we talked about was being aggressive about rebounds because of this fucking kid. You know? Oh, and he's tiny, right? And so... During the game, like, it's hard not, and Luka's playing against him the entire game, because I'm like, this is, you have to try to shut him down. You know what I mean? I'm like, do your best to shut, and they had a couple of other good players, but it was like, our team was exhausted after, because they were just working so hard with this kid who's just, like, putting in so much energy. He was, like, just, like, tiny firebrand, right? Like, you've seen these kids just, like, going, and he didn't shoot a high percentage, but he was shooting his shot. Like, just taking shot after shot after shot, never passing. I'm getting so frustrated on the sideline. Like, that's the reason that I didn't want to coach this team going into the year. Because I was like, I don't want to go through the experience of being frustrated at seven-year-olds on the sideline. You know what I mean? And so later, like, Luka's much bigger than him. And he's just, like, crowding him, like, so tight on defense. And I'm like, if this was me, right, and I don't condone this behavior, but... There would have been some elbows flying.
No,
like,
no.
You know the deal. You know the deal when you play against me. It's just like...
Yeah, I do know the deal. I don't like the
not
deal.
Not anymore. As a child. Like, as an adult, I don't do this at all. But I've moved past my basketball aggression.
Since the flagrant foul?
It's been cleansed from my body. But it's just like, it hasn't been cleansed from my coaching body. But I'm just like, use your body a little bit. Let them know whose space is whose space. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, Luka, just like... You know, just give him a bump. Give him a tap here or there, right? But the reality is, I wouldn't have done that when I was playing. Because when I was playing basketball, do you know who I was?
Who are you?
I was the obnoxious fucking kid.
Oh, no.
I was the kid on the other team. And that's what was frustrating about it.
I thought you were that good.
This kid wasn't that good. He was just really aggressive. You know?
That sounds like good to me.
He was pretty good. But it was like... He was so aggressive as opposed to everybody else on the court that like if you want the ball enough, you're going to get the ball, right? And like if you want... The
ball finds energy.
And also, I'm just like playing fast and loose with the rules, right? I was just like, just, you know, give him a little nudge. But I love you shaking your head at this. This is why the coach's corner is a great segment.
It's a good thing I'm probably going to be back on the, I don't know if I'm going to be on the sidelines, but back there on Saturday.
I'm like, I've got a lot of trips planned when there are basketball games. I might be going on February 8th to see Crystal Ball and Sagar and Jetty. We'll see. I might be going to LA. February 29th, I've got a wedding to go to, so I'm definitely missing. I might miss like three quarters of these games. So the end of the game, fourth quarter, right? We've just been like kind of beaten down. Like we scored points. Like the team played fairly well, but one of our players is bringing the ball up court. And so the rule is you can't defend in backcourt and you can't steal the ball while somebody's dribbling.
Correct.
Right? So one of our kids is like dribbling the ball up court. She like got a rebound, is excited about it. And this fucking kid comes up from behind and steals it. And me and Katie, I swear to God, we jumped out of our seats so fast. It was like Robert Horry just pushed Steve Nash over. You know what I mean? Like I have never been more outraged. And the ref called it, right? But it was just like, I'm losing my mind at this children's basketball game if they don't call this foul. Because he came up from behind and just stole it. And I was like, cool. Happy Thanksgiving, kid.
He's seven.
Come on! It was just like egregious with the rules. All we do, Luca is very good at the rules. Probably too good. He has too much of you in him.
It's very true.
He's just like so concerned with the rules of who he can defend and who he can't defend and when he can steal and when he can't steal. He has no boundary put. He's not a habitual line stepper at all.
He's not going to move down to the 100 level during the snowstorm when there's no one at the Sonics.
God, no. He will sit in those seats he purchased whether he likes it or not.
He will like it.
And if he did move begrudgingly because he had to, he would pour sweat that entire time and stress about it. But it was just like, he's so consumed with the idea of the rules. And then after, I was talking about that play, and one of the parents was like, his dad was like, oh, good training for the future or whatever. And I was just like, okay, cool.
So that's Coach's Corner this week.
That was a good coach's corner.
Maybe canceled after this week. I don't know. It's to be seen.
Might be canceled. I wish we would have had it last year when an ambulance was called during one of our games.
I didn't know that. Well, you did say on Saturday night after the game that you wished I had brought my recording equipment over so we could have recorded right then while it was fresh in your mind.
I am telling you, when that kid stole the ball, like me and Katie, you're not supposed to stand, but me and Katie jumped out of our seats. It was just like, that was not going to fly. The refs called it, though. The refs
on top of it. Let's get into, let's go from written sports to Seattle sports, starting with an NHL to Seattle update. First off, last week, the Oakview Group announced a partnership with Alaska Airlines along with NHL Seattle, highlighted by naming rights to Alaska Airlines Atrium at the new arena currently under construction.
It rolls off the tongue.
The atrium will be new at the south end of the existing roof and will serve as the primary entry point for the arena.
Does MVP status get you anything there?
Unclear. Media tour of the new construction site took place on Tuesday as the excavation process nears completion. The crews have begun drilling the new foundation for the arena as they prepare to meet up with the roof that's currently suspended above the site. Most interesting note that came out of that is that we should have a more accurate timeline on completion by April or May once the foundation is complete and attached to the roof. You'll recall that it's currently tentatively set for June 2021, which would be after the start of the WNBA season. So the Seattle Storm, watching that closely. Also, we got the Storm 2020 schedule last week after we recorded the podcast. And I had alluded to going up to Mill Creek before a Storm game, but it turns out I won't have the opportunity to do that during hashtag teriyaki season because the Storm will play the first half of their season at Heck Ed, where they played the majority of games last year. And then after the Olympic break that they're taking in July and August, we'll be exclusively up in Everett at the Angel of the Winds arena, not on the location of Angel of the Winds Casino. Lastly, on the NHL Seattle front, a note that the Las Vegas Golden Knights fired their coach Gerard Gallant last week. You'll recall that he led the Knights to the Stanley Cup Finals as an expansion team and could be an interesting NHL Seattle candidate given his experience. Yeah, a lot of very successful coaches getting fired at the NHL right now. Strange times in the NHL. We'll maybe someday get to be a part of that. We're not doing your favorite segment this week.
Let's just try it.
All right.
Let's see how it goes.
It's the triumphant return of your favorite segment. Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Well, I saw the news recently that Felix Hernandez signed a minor league contract with the Atlanta Braves. And you know what his nickname is, right?
King Felix?
It's world champion King Felix, who signed this contract with the Atlanta Braves because the Seattle Mariners were awarded the 2017 World Championship Trophy. That's right! After every single team in Major League Baseball, except for the Seattle Mariners, clearly were cheated.
We're cheating?
We're cheating. The World Series trophy was retroactively awarded to the Seattle Mariners, who in a four-game sweep over forfeit won the 2017 World Series. Fans filed in to, at the time, Safeco Field and awaited the Mariners as they walked into the stadium and then collected their forfeit championship. It was the most incredible moment in Seattle sports since their 1994 championship that they won on KJR.
It also is up there with the 1960 UW Huskies football national championship. Third Pelton brother Mina Kimes had a great tweet about this last week. The great thing about being a Mariners fan is that I can say with absolute confidence that my team never won a World Series by cheating. Yeah, Felix trying to make the Braves non-roster invite to training to a spring training, aiming for the fifth starter job. It's gonna be very odd to see Felix in a uniform that is not the Mariners, or I guess maybe like the Aqua Sox or the Rainiers on rehab starts.
I don't think you'll have to worry too much about it.
Well, in spring training, even. On the Sounders front, the team is...
You're going to watch a lot of spring training.
The highlights Florida will probably be on here.
Whatever. You're counting down to the days until pitchers and catchers report. It's really not that many.
Very few. Very few. Under a month. After a week of training in Seattle, the Sounders now headed to California for the next 10 days. Multiple reports out of Brazil indicate that the Sounders have finalized a deal for Botafogo defensive midfielder João Paulo. Apparently structured as a loan that turns into a purchase in 2021, according to these reports, which would allow the Sounders to avoid using a designated player spot on João Paulo, who turns 29 in March, is a defensive midfielder, would presumably push Christian Roldan to the right wing spot now that Jovan Jones is moving back to left back with Brad Smith's departure, though also gives the Sounders the option of moving Gustav Svensson to center back at times during the early part of the season, depending on their timetable for adding a veteran starter at that position. So some things happening with the Sounders roster, but more to come on that front before they start play next month. Reign FC officially introduced Fareed Benstidi as the new Reign FC manager last week. In an interview with Ride of the Valkyries on Sounder at Heart, Reign FC CEO Bill Predmore described the vetting process that took place before they settled on Benstidi. Said he spoke to Lindsay Horan's agent about her experience playing for Benstidi at PSG that we talked about last week, led to concerns that she was shamed about her weight. Predmore's quote, "If we were bringing somebody in, the most important thing was that the players are comfortable with him. In all cases, players were supportive of the decision to move forward with Fareed." And his conclusion, "This was not a pattern of behavior or indicative of a larger issue with Fareed." Moving on to UW football, rising junior linebacker Ariel Nata announces his decision to transfer, which means he's Nata going to play for the Huskies next season. He started 2019 as an outside linebacker and edge rusher in the Huskies 3-4 scheme, moved to inside linebacker for the Arizona game and was part of their effective defensive effort against Khalil Tate, but then saw diminishing playing time the remainder of the season, so not a huge surprise that he's put his name in the transfer portal.
Not great, though.
Lose a little experience to depth there, certainly. But you know, we saw some young players take over at that position with Eddie Ulofosio and Kyler Mata, and got to figure they're the future of that inside linebacker position. And Husky's pretty deep now at outside linebacker with the addition of Savelle Smalls to the group that's returning from last year.
Hello.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to say, our friend Christian Capel of The Athletic put together like his five freshmen that were most likely to see playing time. And he did a good breakdown of true freshmen who had played in the past, which is often in the secondary where they play a lot of players, and out wide receiver, same thing, where you rotate through a lot of guys. But he had like Savelle Smalls like fourth on that list. And I got to say, I think he's at the top of mine.
Yes. I mean, Savelle Smalls should have like Shaq Thompson as a freshman level impact.
I mean, I don't want to set the bar that high, but...
He was recruited that high.
He was.
Savelle Smalls did not commit to UW to not have an impact. I mean, we don't know how he'll play on the field, I suppose, but like he's going to be on the field.
And it's a position where they could use some help, at least in terms of converting pressure into sacks. UW women's basketball suffered a pair of losses at home last week to ranked team 67-50 on Friday versus number 18 ASU, and then 66-58 to number 21 Arizona on Sunday in a game that they led at halftime. But the Wildcats controlled the second half of that one. Does it get much easier for the Huskies coming up on Friday? They travel to face number 10 UCLA before facing USC on Sunday. UCLA was the last unbeaten in the Pac-12 before being stunned by winless USC in double overtime on Sunday at the Galen Center, dropping three spots in the AP rankings. Trojans freshman Alyssa Peely was named Conference Freshman of the Week after dropping a 19.17 rebound double-double in the win for the Trojans.
I mean, every team in the Pac-12 is ranked in the top 10, so...
USC is not. They're the one.
They found the one. But then that team just upset UCLA.
Exactly. Yep. We wrap up with UW men's basketball, which at home last weekend got a 64-56 win on Thursday versus Oregon State. And then, despite leading much of the way, suffered a 64-61 overtime loss Saturday versus number 7 Oregon, with Peyton Pritchard supplying the dagger, the game-winning three-pointer in the final seconds of this
one. I meant to say this during the coach's corner, but if you want to reprise here, you liked it so much, you want to hear more of it. During that game...
Yeah, tell me more about trying to like, play physically with 7 years.
I was feeling frustrated about the game in front of me that was happening, right? Just being like, I don't know what to do with these players. And then I'm like, well, at least the Huskies, I let myself get hope.
Oh, no, that was a huge mistake.
Which, when I went in, the Huskies were up by like 12. And so I check my phone and I'm like, it's in overtime. And then I checked my phone again later. And like, there's basketball happening. I'm looking and I'm like, they lost in the last second three. And I'm like, kill me right now. I'm going to channel all this upsetness that I have at a 7-year-old.
Okay, let's talk about the Thursday game first, because it was pretty exciting. Like we were very down on UW men's basketball last week after the Quad A Green ineligibility and their loss at Cal. And then they played really well against Oregon State. One of the storylines of the weekend was that true freshman Marcus Sahonis has emerged as their top point guard. He had played 21 total minutes in his career before Thursday, then played 29 against Oregon State and 36 against Oregon, combining for 25 points and 5 assists on 10 of 22 shooting in those games. It was also a big game on Thursday night for another freshman, Raekwon Battle, who got the start because Jaden McDaniels sat that game out with a minor ankle injury. He went 3 of 5 from 3, all in the first half, surpassing his previous season total of 3s. And the Huskies kind of dominated the first half of that game and were never really threatened. It wasn't as close as the final score indicated. It was exciting because it was, you know, Isaiah Stewart didn't even have a big game. It was a lot of guys who were probably going to be part of the roster next year who were kind of buoying that win over the Beavers. Did you watch that game? Do you have any thoughts on this?
I mean, I watched the game. No, I thought it was good. But it was just like, it was fool's gold.
I don't know if it was fool's gold.
They were hitting threes at a clip that we knew they could not continue to hit threes at.
I mean, people got a little too excited about the Raekwon Battle performance, and then everyone was criticizing Hop about not playing him earlier. There were some shades of the Jake Kyman game against UW. Like, it wasn't as big as that, where he made like...
They were not that Jake Kyman. Like, come on.
He made like 6 threes in the game winner. And then he scored 22 points in that game, Kyman. In his next 3 games combined, he scored 14 points.
What the hell? Why does the this happen?
But that's what Oregon State is asking about Raekwon Battle, who then went 1 of 9 from three.
But the rest of the team is good enough to have beaten Oregon State. The Jake Hyman game is not the same. UCLA was not, at that moment, that Husky team. UCLA was not a good enough team to have beaten UW on the road. This was UW at home. Like, UW probably should have beaten Oregon State, especially when they shot threes like this.
It was also surprising that the Beavers just struggled so much to score, given that we mentioned they came in as a top 20 offense nationally.
Yeah, that was pretty strange. I kept thinking back to that and being like, am I remembering this correctly?
You are.
They're good at offense?
Tre Stickle was the only one who was doing anything for Oregon State on that in that game.
Just hearing the name Tre Stickle, don't mention the other name. You shall not be named.
Stevie Thompson?
No.
Oh, Peyton. You know, the good news is, so we went through this afterwards. We've learned that they did not play that many games against the Huskies, Tre Stickle, and
that actually makes it worse.
Because it feels like they played so many games. And the record was held by Jonathan Lloyd, who played for Oregon from 2011 through 2014 and played the Huskies 11 times during that span, twice every year during the regular season, 2 Pac-12 tournament games. And then I had forgotten about this fun wrinkle that they played each other in the NIT in 2012 when the Huskies won that game to go to the NIT Final Four at Madison Square Garden.
It was one of the most thrilling moments in the late era Romar period.
It really was. It really was. So Isaiah Stewart was awesome against Oregon.
You just have to stop right there. Isaiah Stewart is awesome.
He is, but he was especially awesome against Oregon. 25 points, 19 rebounds, 5 blocks, 12 of 15 on free throws, played 43 of the 45 minutes. He was the best player on the court. Unfortunately, Peyton...
What happened in the end? Like...
So two things happen. Number one, I had this thought at halftime, like the Huskies can't let it be a 10-point game because then Peyton Pritchard is going to take over. But number two, I hadn't really thought about until it happened, which is Oregon likes to press when they're down. Uh-huh. And guess who's not very good at breaking presses?
The Huskies did well against the press for a long time, though. Like when I was watching the game before I left, they were breaking the press pretty comfortably.
One thing they were doing, I was DMing on Instagram about this with the listener, Matthew Hollister, is like, they were breaking the press, and they were just kind of like backing it out and trying to run time off the clock, even after it got down to like a 5-point lead. And at that point, like if you can get a score, it's way more important than 30 seconds, especially because their half-court offense was bad at that point.
Defense prevents you from winning.
I mean, Hop, in his post-game press conference, he didn't specifically address that, but one thing he said is that they got fatigued down the stretch. I mean, Sahonis played, like I said, 36 minutes in this game. He had played 21 in his career before Thursday.
Why does Peyton Pritchard never get fatigued?
Well, guess who plays 45 minutes all the time? It's Peyton Pritchard. I mean, that's part of what
being... How many overtime games does Oregon play? He plays 45 minutes all the time.
They've played more than one ultimate. This was not their first overtime game of the season.
Did he play all 45 minutes?
I don't remember him being out of the game.
He's that kid from...
Yeah, he played all 45 minutes. He did it. He did it against Arizona. He only played 40 in the win at Michigan. That also went to overtime. He played 38 against Gonzaga in an overtime game. Like, look, this happens a lot to Oregon, I should say. A shocking amount. They've won 3 out of the 4 overtime games they've played so far this season. But it was very similar to that Michigan game where Pritchard he hit 3 threes in the first half. He had 9 points. And I was sitting next to Matt Calkins of the Seattle Times. And, you know, at some point during second half, I lean over and I'm like, Pritchard's had 9 points for a
long
time.
Why did you
time.
Point that out? Why did you do that? I knew it was on you in some way.
Yeah, it was.
You just exposed yourself.
And then he did not finish with 9 points. He finished with 22.
You can't point out when a player like Peyton Pritchard is doing badly.
It's very fair. 6 of 12 from 3. So they were their offense was bad, and he attributed it to fatigue. It definitely wasn't like an order from the sidelines, like, hey, we need to try to spend 30 seconds every time, you know, and run out the clock. And then, like we mentioned, Stewart played 43 of the 45 minutes and was just getting beaten on all game by multiple Oregon defenders. So it wouldn't be surprising if he fatigued a little bit as well, even though he continued making plays whenever he was able to get the ball. The fact that the Huskies did not shoot particularly well from the perimeter in the second half was a big factor. Jaden McDaniels shot 1 of 9 from this game. Like I mentioned, Battle was 1 of 8 from 3.
We just knew it was coming. I knew this was happening. Even when I had hope, I knew this was coming.
Yeah.
It would have, like, this win could have potentially saved the season.
It would have substantially bolstered their, it would have put them back on the bubble, is what it would have done. And right now they are not on the bubble. They're off.
How far did Oregon fall with their loss to Wazoo before then?
I have not looked that up.
That's just also what stung was. They just lost to Wazoo earlier in the week. You know, Oregon didn't come in looking invincible.
They dropped four spots down from 8 to 12, from 8 to 13 in the coaches' poll. So.
All right, what's next?
This weekend, the Huskies head to
Do you think it was, and granted, Raekwon Battle also shot badly on Saturday. Do you think it was any help to the Huskies not having Jaden McDaniels on Thursday?
Certainly not in defense, where we mentioned they played so well. Probably not. Because it wasn't like they redirected all their offense to Stewart. He didn't score that much in that game.
It was just Raekwon Battle played well.
Yeah. And okay. Sahonis.
Sahonis, by the way, for the record, looks kind of legit. He'll have bad games, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. He's a freshman point guard.
But, like, he's a very smooth basketball player. And when he drives, he's got... He needs to hit more of these, but he's got pretty solid finishing moves in the paint.
One of the things that surprised me is, like, I thought of him primarily as a shooter first, and he looked really comfortable from mid-range, operating with the ball in his hands. He looked comfortable in that role, even though the scouting report I had gotten of him was that he was primarily a shooting guard who was playing point guard out of need. So that's interesting, especially, you know, we'll see what happens with Quade Green going forward next season.
How highly was he, like, recruited?
Schmedium. Not as highly. I mean, he was the number four recruit in this class. Battle was a bigger recruit than he was, really? I would say. Huh. So, yeah. Impressive stuff. So the Huskies head this weekend to the Mountain Schools on Thursday at Utah, then Saturday at number 23, Colorado. Utah has had an up-and-down season. Wins over three likely NCAA tournament teams so far, being BYU, Minnesota, and Kentucky. The first two of those teams at home and Kentucky at T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas, but then also lost at Coastal Carolina and to Tulane on a neutral site. They have lost their last four conference games since beating Oregon State in the Pac-12 opener. The last three of those by a combined 74 points. They're barely in the top 200 in defensive rating and last by a mile in conference play, partially because of opponents shooting 41% from three-point range against them. They are the third youngest team in Division I per KenPom.com's measure of that. No upperclassmen among their top eight players in minutes per game, which include five freshmen and three sophomores. The player to watch among that group is freshman point guard Rylan Jones, who is a 45% three-point shooter and in the top 100 nationally in assist rate. And Bill Walton couldn't stop raving about him during that Kentucky game.
I'm sure. I watched some of the end of that game. It was fun.
It was. Utah didn't look super great at the end of that game. They were like UW trying to get to the finish line against Oregon. They got there.
That's what college basketball is. It's all the same.
A lot of it is.
It's always the same.
Number 23, Colorado. I had this as fell out of, they fell out of the coaches rankings. They're still number 23 in the AP poll after losing to Arizona on the road on Saturday. They've suffered a pair of surprising home losses this season to Northern Iowa and Oregon State. Their other loss besides those two in the loss at Arizona was at number one Kansas, or not number one in the AP, but number one in the KenPom. Their best wins versus Dayton in overtime in Chicago. Dayton off to a great start, won the Maui Invitational, and at home against Oregon in their Pac-12 opener. The Buffs are number 20 nationally in adjusted defensive rating. Pretty good across the board there. Notably allow very few free throws. Shoot 36% from three-point range. And forward Tyler Bay has developed into one of the conference's best players. Versatile defender, excellent defensive rebounder who attempts six free throws a night. Point guard McKinley Wright is fourth in the Pac-12 in assist rate. And in contrast to a young Utah team, Colorado has the highest year-to-year minutes continuity in the entire NCAA.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is a team that people thought coming into this year, like they were going to be much improved because they were bringing so much back. And in this case, everyone was right.
They are. So, where are they ranked in KenPom?
A little bit lower than they are in the rankings. They're number 31 in KenPom.
God. KenPom hates the Pac-12.
The Pac-12 results hate the Pac-12, as it turns out. They're the number two or the number three ranked KenPom team in the Pac-12 behind Oregon and Arizona. Just ahead of Stanford has climbed all the way up to 35 now.
So best case scenario, the Huskies split this weekend.
I don't know if it's the best case scenario. It's definitely the most likely scenario. Like, they've got a pretty good chance of getting a win at Utah. That's one of their better chances of getting a road win. Although you would have said the same about Cal, and they did not get that road win.
I'm chalking it up when I was feeling positive about the weekend before the Oregon loss, when I was like, wow, they're
really... I still feel positive about the weekend.
But like, I'm saying when I was feeling really positive.
Okay.
It was just like, you know, they just found out about Quad A. They didn't know what to make of the Quad A suspension in that weekend in the Northern California schools.
To be clear, the coaching staff knew about it before it was announced to the public.
But just like, there's a difference between knowing about it and playing without Quad A. And I think it takes a second.
Well, they made a dramatic transition. I mean, Elijah Hardy started both of those games, played the majority of the minutes at point guard in them. The other minutes they played primarily with the Bay Carter backcourt, the on-the-run backcourt, which teamed up for an amazing alley-oop on Thursday night. Achieved liftoff, of course. But he played 31 minutes in the game at Stanford, still played 14 in the game at Cal, did not see action in either game last weekend.
So that's a big... They were definitely still feeling it out.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's a difference between practice and playing games. And they just needed a couple games to sort of get comfortable with Sahonis playing, you know?
One of the interesting things about this stretch without Quad A Green in the lineup is, even though it has done huge damage to the Huskies' NCAA tournament hopes, their KenPom ranking actually hasn't gone down almost at all.
It's only been a couple games.
They went from 42 to 45.
Huh.
Like, even if you go back to, like, that's where they were ranked after the UCLA game. Like, so they're kind of the same team, but now they're losing close games that they won. You know, they won the Baylor game in particular. It was a big close game. Their losses have come by 4-2, 6-3, and 3 the last two in overtime. So
wait, so what's their Pac-12 record right now?
2-4.
And they're basically two close games away from having a 4-2 record.
Yeah, I mean, they have a massively positive point differential in Pac-12.
Or even, I mean, you take out that Kaiman 3, the overtime loss at Cal where they just look discombobulated, and if they could have held on against Oregon, and all of a sudden we have, like, potentially a top 25 team still.
Yeah.
Well, just rationalize that.
still.
Let's go to the mountains.
Number one defensive rating in Pac-12 play so far. Wow. Number 11 in offensive rating. But I definitely feel much better about the rest of the season going forward than I did last week.
I
was ready to cancel the rest of the season. Then I'm not going to do that now. So we'll see how I feel after the game at Utah.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't, a little bit of programming note, if you haven't had enough of us, which I assume you have, but if you haven't, we are also going to be on episode 106, which should be debuting today as you're listening to this, of Tasteful Profanity, a Beast Pod production, in a different conversation than this one was.
Very, very different energy for that one. Yeah,
where I said that running backs matter, and I compared Ben Baldwin to Donald Trump.
Oh boy. Oh. Yeah, there was no Seahawks talk, really, very little in this one. A lot of Seahawks talk there, so get your fix of that. And
thanks.